Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. A little reminder, we are Zooming this show on Monday afternoon, so if something should happen on Monday night, we'll be discussing it on Wednesday. You've come to expect this, and we've begun every show since March with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I made that decision because I was so impressed with his ability to talk truth to power. To be honest with you. And then when he told his father it would be all right, I wanted to sort of tap him on the shoulder and say, it's not going to be all right, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. And I was right. And the country is now figuring it out as we are beginning to vote in droves. But we're going to continue to play his testimony between now and Election Day because I want his words ringing in your ears as you exercise the franchise in any way you choose to do it. But just make sure you go to the polls and you vote. All right, now, the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, impeachment hearings 2019.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry, I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Matt Stoller has written a book, Goliath, the 100-year war between monopoly power and democracy. And rumor has it, it's coming out in paperback just today, I believe. But more importantly, his passion and his focus is really on monopolies and the concentration of corporate power. And I so value his voice. I value his knowledge. And I think your time is coming, Matt. I think we're all beginning to wake up at the same time going, this may not be such a good thing. So in a lot of ways, I'm glad you're with us because as we're beginning to explore this issue in greater detail, I think you are the best person to sort of be our roadmap. I just went to your site called BIG. And literally an hour before I get on the air, I noticed that you've posted something that's entitled, How Would President Biden Approach Corporate Power? The War Over Monopolies Will Define the Next Administration. And I only got to read the first five or six pages, but I was a little hopeful, Matt. And that's a good thing, because what you said is he's not Barack Obama, and that to a large extent, he's not almost ideological about this. As you point out, I think in your piece, he likes foreign policy. That's kind of his area of expertise. And what I know about Joe Biden is his relationship to Delaware, which obviously is a problem, but also because of the credit card industry. But that was his relationship to state and geography. It may not necessarily define him as president. So let me welcome you to the program and tell me what you have uncovered as you've begun to talk to people about how the Biden administration will approach the issue of, you know, trust busting and monopolies, and really what you think he will bring into his administration. And maybe you can even throw out some possible names if you know any of them. So welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah. I mean, all of this is, of course, contingent upon whether he wins or not. So this is a more of a hypothetical piece. But so that you got to say that up front.
I know.
So the piece, it's a long piece because I talked to a number of people to try to understand what Biden will do. And the reason it's so hard is because I don't think Biden has decided what he's going to do around the question of antitrust and monopoly power. And the reason is his campaign, they don't want to repeat what Hillary Clinton did. Hillary Clinton was trying to figure out how to govern before she won the election. So these guys are saying, we're going to win the election first, and then we're going to make decisions about how to govern. And you can take issue with that. I think it's somewhat problematic, but that's the way that they're thinking about the world. So in order to understand what Biden will do, you have to kind of go into his background. You have to look at the overall environment. And that's what I tried to do in this piece.
So just to give you a second. My understanding of about, I mean, Joe's, I mean, you have to go back decades. I mean, because he's been around forever. And I've always said that he becomes the moment. So if you're in a more progressive moment, I think he'll become more progressive. If you're in a more corporate moment, he'll become more corporate. I don't think that he has a sort of a strict ideology. And one of the things I read was you said a sharp break from the Obama era. I think he's not like Obama. I think Obama was very much of a new Democrat. He very much was sort of schooled in sort of having a relationship with corporate America and Wall Street. That was really how he was raised. That's not how Joe Biden was raised. So I think if nothing else, just knowing where they both started gives me hope about what he can become as president.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two things. There's two significant reasons that Biden is going to be a very different president than Obama on these particular issues. And the first is they just believed in different things. You're right. I mean, Obama is a real hardcore neoliberal, believed strongly, you know, loved the tech guys in Silicon Valley, Google, Facebook, Amazon, was, you know, thinks of Wall Street as this kind of essential place and has strong ideas about concentrating the need to concentrate power. That's the way that Obama thinks about the world. You know, trust experts. And who knows more about banking than bankers? Who knows more about technology than tech CEOs? That's Obama, right?
Yeah.
Biden's not like that. Biden isn't, he's no populist. He's no like fire. He's sort of mild. He's got a mild populism, but he's more of a transactional Democrat. So for him, he's not that interested in corporate power. He's a foreign policy guy. And he kind of just uses corporations to kind of get what he wants. So he'll use them for fundraising. You know, he was from Delaware, so he'll do what the Delaware companies want, which are the credit card companies, but he doesn't care that much. He's just friends with a lot of people and he's going to bring in his friends into the administration. So right away, what you're saying, I'm not saying he's like this great anti-monopolist, but I'm saying what I think the deal with Obama is people didn't notice just how I think problematic his policy framework was on corporate power. But the other thing, and I think this is probably as important, if not more important, is that the environment is just totally different today than it was in 2008. And, you know, we're in the midst of a very strong anti-monopoly movement, which has been saying, you know, we have big tech platforms and you got business, you got academia, you got both parties are sort of frustrated with corporate power. And that's just the total opposite of 2008. So, you know, I don't want to blame, you know, I don't want to put this all on sort of Obama's beliefs. You know, keep in mind, in 2011 at Occupy Wall Street, when Steve Jobs died, people there had a moment of silence for Steve Jobs and they were tweeting out Apple slogans, hashtag Occupy Wall Street. So we've really changed, broadly speaking, everyone's changed their views of market power and monopoly power. It's just a completely different intellectual environment. And then I guess the last thing, and this is also an environmental shift, the economy is far more concentrated today. So, you know, you got basically five companies that are responsible for most stock market gains. That's the big, you know, Google, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, and Microsoft. And, you know, you don't even have enough. There aren't 5,000 companies to fill up the Wilshire 5,000 stock index. There are only 3,500. And that's because there's been so many mergers. So we're in a far more concentrated economy. So it's a completely different environment. And there's basically no way, I think, for anyone, even if Trump gets reelected, to pursue a sort of lax policy on anti-monopoly rules.
Well, no, I want to go back to Obama as we look at Obama versus Biden. And again, part of the difference is that at least with Biden, you have a real history of sort of being able to evaluate how he changes, what is his passion, what is not his passion. Right. Barack Obama was a U.S. senator for a year before he decided to run for president. And then you take a look at who he brought in, Geithner and Summers and Mary Jo White, and I'm thinking, oh my God, slit my wrists, you know? And then you realize that he celebrated the fact that he was a new Democrat. What's interesting is Biden also says he's a new Democrat, but I think there's a different kind of new with both of them. One was new because that was what the moment defined, but I think Barack Obama definitely was a new Democrat, you know, with all the bells and whistles that implied it. But as we look at Joe, you go back and you actually do a real interesting historical look when he was chair of the judiciary. So let's start with what he did with Stephen Breyer, because I thought that was incredibly fascinating, because what he said, although he approved him, gives you a sort of a window in on where his maybe emotional tendencies are.
Yeah, I mean, I think Barack Obama is very much an elitist. Right. I mean, he loves Ivy League degrees. He loves credentialism. Joe Biden doesn't necessarily look down on elite credentials, but he does kind of resent them. And I think you saw this, you know, that, I mean, that matters.
No, I know.
You saw this. So in 1994, Stephen Breyer, who's, you know, Supreme Court Justice, he was nominated in 94 and he comes before Biden, and he was nominated along with Ruth Bader Ginsburg because they were pro-business, right? Because they were pro-monopoly. That's why there was no controversy when they got put on the court. It wasn't because everyone was, you know, lovely and bipartisan. It's because they were going to do what business wanted. So Stephen Breyer's specialty was deregulation. He was Ted Kennedy's staffer when Kennedy and Carter deregulated airlines. And he was well known as somebody who would strike down regulations when economists said that they were too costly. So he gets put in front of the Judiciary Committee. And Howard Metzenbaum, who's an anti-monopolist, is the only one who's really like, this guy's a problem. Same with RBG. But Biden also says, you know, I really am offended by your way of doing cost-benefit analysis. I think it's elitist and presumptuous to say that Americans would change their culture if they knew, they really knew the costs. He called it Harvard ease and said that he is glad. He's like, he's sort of sarcastic. He's like, I'm glad that you're not going to take those policy preferences with you on the court because you're just going to be a judge. So I was like, this is really weird because Biden's this guy who supported the bankruptcy bill, NAFTA, China, PNTR. You know, he has a pretty pro-corporate record. So to see him with this kind of populist moment kind of attacking the core of like of the neoliberal ideological project was weird. And it kind of suggested that, you know, Biden's instincts are not necessarily completely the same as his overall track record. But again, I'm not like saying this guy is going to be this wonderful anti-monopolist. It's just that relatively speaking, he's a different person than Obama. And I think his instincts are just different.
So one of the things I was talking to people, because, you know, you look, I mean, I had all these issues with Biden because Biden, you know, embraced the crime bill and the welfare reform bill and the repeal of Glass-Steagall and all this other stuff. And someone said to me, you don't get it, Arnie. Biden was being loyal to Bill Clinton. It wasn't about that this was what his policy preferences were, but Clinton calls up and says, I want this, and he delivers this. I want that, he delivers this. I mean, Clinton's the one who picked Breyer. Clinton's the one that picked RBG. Let's remember who made the choice. And basically what was Joe Biden's job on the Judiciary Committee was to deliver Clinton's choice. So I think what's interesting about this sort of split screen between what Clinton obviously wanted. He liked what Breyer was delivering because he was a new Democrat, because he wanted to make love with Wall Street. He was impressed with corporate power. So I think what you saw with Biden was, if this was a choice that I would make, I wouldn't be making him, but I'll approve him. You know, I'll vote for him. And that gives me some hope that he's a bit of an empty vessel when it comes to this issue. And the question then becomes, who's going to be front in line pouring stuff into that empty vessel? And I'm hoping that there are some strong voices in Congress that will be there to kind of push him in the right direction, because they'll be his backstop in a lot of ways. And I think that will be useful.
Well, who's he been listening to all these years, for 30 years in the Senate? Who influences Biden? Because he certainly hasn't been making it hard for Wall Street to accumulate billions of dollars.
Credit card companies, banks.
Yeah. So why would you expect him to be more progressive next year?
So I think that he wasn't on the, so he's a foreign policy guy. That's what he's interested in. Exactly. And he's, you know, so that's where he focused. But I think that that's an important point. I mean, Biden, it's not like Biden was like reluctantly carrying water for Clinton on this stuff. You know, Biden has like his track record is his track record. And, you know, he picked Kamala Harris as VP. So it's not like, I'm not saying, again, I'm not trying to like make an optimistic sort of point here. What I'm saying is like Biden is just more influenced by the prevailing winds than Obama was. It's hard to make the argument like, oh, Biden could be better without sort of seeming to say Biden is good, but that is not actually what I'm saying. But I think your point about Congress is really the key one. It's this kind of later in the piece. Congress is very different than it was in 2008. So 2009, when Obama took office, you had Congress people who largely got elected on an anti-Iraq war, anti-Bush frame, and they really didn't have any views of political economy. It's not what they ran on. It's not what they understood. But I think that today you're going to see, you have senators like Elizabeth Warren and Richard Blumenthal and Josh Hawley and just sort of a whole series of others. And then in the House, more importantly, you have David Cicilline, who has put forward this remarkable antitrust report. So it's not like, you know, the Obama guys, you know, I was working on the Financial Services Committee in 2009 and 10. They handed the Barney Frank a bill and said, pass this. And that's essentially what happened. And Barney just, didn't want the members on the committee to have any influence. But that's not going to happen this time because David Cicilline, or it's less likely to happen this time because David Cicilline and Elizabeth Warren and a series of others have their own agenda, and Congress might be, you know, to the extent that Congress is the main policymaking branch in America again, then Biden will have relatively less control. This isn't something that Biden cares that much about, so he's probably willing to defer to like progressives on this because, again, you know, Obama really took pleasure in like destroying the left. He just like hated liberals. And I don't think Biden is like that. Biden's just like, whatever, I'm going to bring everyone in and I want to not have fights. And if I can make the left like me by throwing them a few bones here and there, fine. So I think it's just like a different dynamic. And I think the problem that I think a lot of liberals and left wingers have is truly understanding how bad Obama was, really understanding like just what a terrible president he was, how bad he was on corporate power, the concentration. You know, he walked around Iowa in 2008, said, I'm going to go after Big Ag. They didn't do anything. They in 2009 and 10, they said to farmers, come forward and tell us what the meat packers are doing to you. Don't worry, we won't allow them to retaliate. They didn't do anything. And those farmers were destroyed. But all these people are saying, he's going to go after Google. He's going to go after tech. They're going to bring a Section 2 monopolization case. They didn't bring a single case against a monopoly. And the reason, Carl Shapiro, who was an Obama enforcer, said, we couldn't find any. There just weren't any. And I'm not kidding. That's what he said. So it's like Larry Summers spent his time trying to block the antitrust division from doing anything. I mean, you saw hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of big tech companies, hundreds of acquisitions by big tech companies. Not a single one was stopped. This is when Google, Facebook, and Amazon just exploded in terms of power. These were all, I mean, even Ticketmaster, which everybody hated in the 90s, they bought Live Nation. I mean, this is all the airlines, I mean, it's just crazy. So we have to recognize that we started from just a truly horrific administration. And I, sorry to get so like aggressive about this, but like, I'm talking relative here. So if it's really bad, right? And Bush was bad, Obama was bad, and Trump has been bad. So even being a little less bad is going to look like a significant change. That's kind of where I'm hitting. And it sounds optimistic.
Here's what I'm dying. Remember right after the 2008 economic meltdown, not one Wall Street banker did a perp walk. Okay. Right. We know what happened after the savings and loan. 1,000 bankers went to jail. Nobody went to jail. So I was focused on that. So I was pissed at him, pardon my language, because of that. And then when I read that statement that they could not find one monopoly that they would have to break up, that they didn't exist in the United States. Right. I mean, check my pulse, Matt.
Right.
When you look at those two nuggets of information, I mean, you can't be anything but unhappy. But let me just say something as someone who's been a former politician, okay? I just have to say something. You have to some extent, in order to get elected, reflect your environment. So yeah. I'm going to remind everyone that he did come from Delaware and that Delaware was the home of the credit card industry and that they were his constituents, okay? They were in part what kept him there. They're what fed him there. And that's what he stayed for. He's not going to bite the hand that feeds him. You know why we have Bernie Sanders? Because he comes from frickin' Vermont. I mean, so let's be honest here. Nobody ever pushed back on Bernie. Bernie could be as anti-monopolistic. He could be as pro-labor. He could be as liberal socialist as he wanted. Where? Because he came from Vermont. Let's be honest here. So the good news about
that's true. I'm sorry to be argumentative here.
No, please be argumentative.
I think it's, you know, there are ways of being nice to your home constituents, but not destroying the lives of millions of people with the bankruptcy bill. Like you could put the bill up and then like not succeed and be like, oh, it's too bad.
Chuck Schumer and Hillary Clinton. I mean, come on, honey. I mean, who's their constituent? Chuck Schumer and Hillary Clinton's constituent.
No, I know. I'm just saying that like,
I agree with you.
And I think we all agree here. It's just kind of like what we're all dealing with is that it's just so painful to believe that anyone in politics can do anything good that, like, it's really hard. I mean, I think we're all scarred by that. And so it's hard when I'm, as an analyst, I'm trying to say, here's what's likely to happen because of a lot of environmental factors that are not under Biden's control, as well as Biden being a different person. Biden listened to Ted Kaufman, for example, who is one of the guys that wanted to break up the banks, right? That's his best friend. He also listens to Tom Vilsack and Chris Dodd, who are like corrupt corporate lobbyists. So, but the thing is that it's so hard and so painful for us to say maybe our institutions can deliver, even if a bad, like, even if somebody that we don't particularly like align with is in charge, it's just a really painful thing to talk about. And it sounds like you're kind of shilling for them, but it's not, but that's just because we haven't seen anyone do anything good for a long time. So it's like, it just feels like it's dishonest, or it feels like it's shilling. It isn't necessarily, it's just that things are really bad right now. So even doing things a little bit differently will have a big impact.
Matt, you say it's painful to think that we might get something good out of Biden, but I think it's the opposite. I'm in pain because I'm scared to death that we're not going to get anything good out of Biden. We're so wrapped up in expecting it to be so much of an improvement, getting Trump out of there, which it certainly will be in a lot of ways. But in terms of being beholden to corporate interests, I mean, it's not just that he came from Delaware. Who the heck do you think he's serving when he got the nomination? You know, he was the guy that was representing the Wall Street and corporate elites, whereas Bernie and Elizabeth were representing the progressive side. And Biden gets his money from the Wall Street. And also Obama. You talk about the things that the Obama administration didn't do to make things more progressive in the economy. Well, who was the vice president in that administration?
Except, let me just stop you there. And Matt, let me just say something. My understanding is that really what he did was he ceded to Biden sort of foreign policy. That was his area of expertise. That's why there was a whole problem with Ukraine. Let's be honest here, everyone. And Barack Obama really sort of took charge of the whole corporate agenda. I think what's interesting, and again, from your article, I was glancing through it, we talked about what's happening in Congress. And you mentioned Cicilline from Rhode Island. And I'm thinking of Jamie Raskin. I'm thinking of Katie Porter. I'm thinking of AOC. I'm thinking about Elizabeth Warren. There are powerhouses now in Congress, in the Senate, in the House that didn't exist before. Their moment has come. The economy is in the crap house. The growing inequality is outrageous. Everyone is furious at Amazon and Google and whatever it is, Facebook. I mean, I was listening to MSNBC.
Here's another reason why it's different. And this to your point, yeah, which is that Biden's, even if you just look at him and you say he's a corporatist, the people that he likes, the corporations he likes, are the telecom guys, the cable guys, Hollywood studios. He doesn't, and they all hate big tech. So there's a war within corporate America itself. Like Steve Ricchetti is maybe his chief of staff. And Steve Ricchetti is an AT&T guy. And AT&T wants Google and Amazon and Facebook regulated because they're getting their clock cleaned. Now, you can say that you know, there are a lot of reasons to be skeptical that, like, Biden will lead the charge against corporate power. But the thing is that corporate sector is now fractured. So there's a lot of, it's a weird environment. And I think, like, this is why monopolization, like Donald Trump is likely to file an antitrust case against the $1 trillion corporation Google. Like, that's crazy. That's something that we would not have expected the most aggressive progressive to do 10 years ago, but Donald Trump is doing it. So this is like a different environment. And that, and a lot of that, I think, is because a lot of businesses are complaining. So it's weird. And I'm not saying that Biden's going to do left-wing things. This is just about, you know, like, because corporate power, I don't think people are trying to understand the problem of corporate power, but it's a very weird and interesting problem. And I think it's very central and it's upstream to a lot of the social issues that we talk about. So that's why I'm like, this is weird. This is not going to be like what we expected. And it's going to be like more disruptive than we might have thought.
Okay, so tell me about.
I could be totally wrong, by the way. But
No. I actually don't think you are. I don't think you are. This sounds so crazy. I disagree with Ken. I actually think that he becomes the moment. I think Biden becomes the moment. I think the moment is recognizing that there's something wrong with corporate power. I think the moment is looking at inequality and saying this is bad. I think people are looking and yearning for competition. I think they're feeling more and more vulnerable. I mean, one of my kids who lived with me from China, it was a lawyer. He just had a baby. You know what they named the baby? Microsoft. They named the baby girl Microsoft. I called him up and I said, what are you doing, Bohan? But I mean, but that's China. That's not here. And I think we're beginning to see people are willing to sort of take on these big companies in a way that didn't exist before. But here's my question for you. There's an opening on the Supreme Court. I want to know, Matt Stoller, that if you could have your way, who would you want to see appointed to the Supreme Court that could bring the kind of sort of anti-corporate, monopoly busting, you know, someone who could embrace regulation? Obviously, the court is going to be off balance for a while unless we start, you know, expanding the size of the court. But give me some names that you think would be really phenomenal there, unlike Breyer, unlike RBG. I don't know how the other folks are on the court.
I think Sotomayor has done a good job. I'm not going to, like, list out names on, I mean, there's people I like, but I think for the court, you know, antitrust is not the only question I would think about, but that's what I do think about. So, but you know, there are some good antitrust lawyers that I would respect. I just think that, I think I would say two things. One, I think it's really important for Democrats to start thinking about corporate power and law. So not to just like Roe v. Wade is important and, you know, Obergefell, a lot of these things are really important, but you also have to think about corporate power, corporations that use the courts, arbitration agreements, because these are also really, really critical. They shape our experiences. So I think that's important. A lot of the Obama and Clinton appointed judges are terrible. Like the Sprint T-Mobile merger should not have been approved. And that was an Obama judge that approved it. So that, I think that's kind of like one part one. There's another one reason I'm not super into court packing, because I think Democrats will nominate a bunch of big law corporate hacks. The other thing I think that is, and I think more importantly, a lot of the problem with the judiciary is not actually an issue of judges. It's that we don't legislate anymore. Yes. And I think that's really the key is that the Supreme Court, they do say some things are unconstitutional here and there, but mostly what they do is they strike down or they interpret laws in narrow ways that Congress can fix. You know, Lilly Ledbetter was overturning a Supreme Court decision. So I think that, you know, the desire to like say we need to pack the court or we need to do something about the judiciary is really, partly it's true, but partly it's an abdication of the responsibility to do politics, right? To change policy through our main policymaking body, which is Congress. And that's why I think the Cicilline report was so important, because he recommended a bunch of different changes, including overturning about 10 different Supreme Court decisions on antitrust law. So I would say that the response to the courts should be legislate, legislate, legislate. Actually start passing laws again. And then if the courts try to stop you, then you go after the courts. But I don't think you start by saying, we need to change the judges so the judges will write better law. I'm not into that. I don't think judges should be reshaping law. I think that's what the right is doing. And that's a big problem. So I would say just make Congress, you know, the centerpiece.
Do their job. Let's remember, Congress basically has been a vacant lot when it comes to policy. And that's a real problem. And I'm going to read from your article again. His article is How Would President Biden Approach Corporate Power? You write, given competing priorities for Biden, the entrenched antitrust bar and a hostile judiciary, quote, the muscle for a Biden administration on antitrust, one experienced advocate told me, will have to come from Congress. Right. Without an aggressive set of advocates from the legislative branch and probably state attorneys generals, antitrust could be something of an administrative backwater. And I think that's where I am hopeful, because I see the people that are percolating through. I saw what happened in 2018. I'm looking at the crop of people that are coming in. I think they need people like Matt Stoller, who hold their hand and sort of educate them on a lot of these things. They know that there's something wrong with the economy. They know there's something wrong with inequality. They know there's something wrong with concentration. They know all this. Then the question becomes, take a look at Cicilline's report. He gave you a roadmap. Here are the things you need to change. The court made these decisions. They're bad. We can fix the bad decisions. And in some ways, I think they're so afraid of the court anyway, Matt. This empowers Congress, especially if it's controlled by Democrats, to actually take charge and do it quickly and nimbly.
I'm with you. Totally with you.
And don't you think they have to go beyond more just enforcing antitrust laws against high tech and Amazon and whatnot, especially the banks and Bain Capital?
I agree. Yeah. I mean, I think that the changes to antitrust law are going to be catalytic across the economy. So yeah, I think we have concentration everywhere. It's a huge problem, not just in tech.
All right. So the title of his book, Goliath, the 100 year between monopoly power and democracy. Everyone, it's now in paperback, so you can get it. And Matt Stoller, thank you so much. Go to Big. It's his fabulous newsletter. Subscribe. And more importantly, we will post How Would President Biden Approach Corporate Power? The information in here is mind boggling because I didn't know so much of it. But you and I have, you know how I describe Barack Obama? Ready for this? Majestic disappointment. That's how I describe Barack Obama. And on that note, I will not describe you that way. Ciao. We will talk soon. Bye-bye, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. We'll be right back.
Early in the morning, she rises, yeah. Woman's work is never done. And it's not because she doesn't try. Fighting a battle with no one on her side. before she rises up in the morning. And she works till we passed us. Woman better slow down, well she's gonna come down hard. Early in the morning she rises, yes. Woman's work is never done.
Hi, this is part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Joining us right now is Harold Meyerson. Harold Meyerson is the editor-at-large at The American Prospect. You go to prospect.org to find it. So much to talk about, Harold, but I guess I noticed that this prospect is actually focusing on sort of family policy, things like daycare, things like elder care. So let's just start here, because we don't do family policy in America.
No, we don't. And we are a complete anomaly in the family of nations. We're the one that, you know, can't seem to get into the door for these family gatherings. Almost alone, we don't do paid sick leave. Every other OECD nation does that. This has been, you know, when we talk about American exceptionalism, there are a lot of downsides to American exceptionalism. And this is one. However, in recent years, there has been more attention paid, largely by the progressive community, to addressing family policy for the very young, for the sick, and for the elderly, which grows more and more important as life expectancies continue to increase. And so what we've done, we had a grant to do a special issue. So there'll be a separate additional print issue coming out on this of the American Prospect. And all this week on the Prospect website, www.prospect.org, we'll be running articles that will be appearing in that special print issue.
I have to ask you, who's cut the check? Who's asking you? I gotta ask this question. You know, I want to.
It's a range of groups, different groups, basically assembled by perhaps the main activist group campaigning for this, Caring Across Generations.
Okay.
Terrific organizer Ai-Jen Poo founded. So we are doing that. And what's really relevant about this is that these are policies and ideas that have filtered up or trickled down, as you prefer, to the Biden campaign. And the Biden campaign really is talking about three kinds, sort of economic stimulus. One is simply renewing the CARES Act in the form of the HEROES Act, which has long since passed the Democratic House, and the Republicans are still deciding if they want to do any of this, sort of the emergency relief for the pandemic. The second is the Biden commitment for traditional and non-traditional infrastructure, which has elements of the Green New Deal. I mean, during the last debate, they kept asking Biden, do you support the Green New Deal? Well, I mean, in essence, he doesn't support the words, but what he's committed to is a lot of the content of the Green New Deal. And then, but the third groundbreaking element of what you would call, the tripartite Biden stimulus is a care stimulus, for which he wants to spend close to $1 trillion on doing exactly, not exactly, but approximately the kinds of things that the wide assortment of authors in this special issue of the American Prospect are calling for: greatly expanded, greatly enhanced child care and elder care that would really be a right of the American people, not a something that exists now that you need to pay an arm and a leg for.
Okay, so as you're talking to the girl politician or politician in recovery, a couple of things I want to note. I saw an article at theconversation.com, and the article at theconversation.com was entitled, "Women Politicians More Likely to Reply to People Who Reach Out in Need." All right, that's what they said. So as I'm listening to what you're doing at The Prospect, let me remind you, when I ran for office in 1984, I had been a part-time worker. Okay. I'd worked 3 part-time jobs. Women are part-time workers. I worked 50 hours a week, but 3 jobs to get to 50. Guess who didn't have access to healthcare because she was a part-time worker?
You.
Moi. Guess who wrote a bill saying part-time workers should have access to group health plans? Moi. Who wrote bills about things like, you know, breast cancer? Moi. And so one of the reasons why I see Joe Biden having the potential to begin to embrace these family-friendly policies is that a couple of things have happened. Inequality, it's grotesque. Women are going to deliver a win for him, and he knows it. We're seeing more women in Congress than we've ever seen before. He has a female vice president. Women are finally beginning to get to a point where they're exercising power. They're getting the critical mass they need in Congress, and they're not going to wait for someone to recognize that there's a problem. They've lived the problem, Harold. That right. is the point. And now they're in a place where they can vote on policy to fix the frickin' problem.
Even for women who've had the ability to work at home on what would normally be their office job during the pandemic, the absence of childcare has been a huge problem. And for women who have to work out of the home, including almost all low-wage women, the fact that schools are closed has been a horrendous problem. So again, the COVID crisis has just cast even a brighter light on our absurd deficiency of basic rights like childcare.
Right. Well, you know, and again, it's so interesting. All my libertarian friends, for the most part, are basically male, you know, and they want to say, you know, you're on your own, Jack. You know, you can take care of yourself. This idea of individual responsibility. And I said, really, who gave birth to you? It took 2 to tango here. Okay. Somebody had to care for you. And we cared for you until you ended up going to high school. And then when you get old and you can't walk around because women are usually healthier than men, I take care of you at the end of life. And all of a sudden you say, you want me to be on my own? Wait a minute. I'm earning less. I'm taking care of everybody. And now they're talking this as being a women's recession as opposed to a male recession. If there was ever a moment for these kind of family friendly, and they're not family friendly. If you don't have strong supports for families, you don't have a strong economy. If you don't have strong supports for families, you don't have a future. So in a lot of ways, we're cutting off our nose to spite our face. I always said the pandemic is the economy. Well, in a lot of ways, these family policies are also the economy.
Oh, absolutely. And again, as you noted, the fact that Biden is likely to be powered into the White House by women voters just makes this, you know, in a sense, this is the most traditional of politics. You pay back the folks who elected you, and the Democratic Party in general and the Joe Biden electorate, I think, in particular, is going to be clearly majority, sometimes in some places, supermajority female.
Yes. So in this conversation article, please don't be offended by this.
I'm not offended.
They said, there is tentative but contested evidence that worldwide women have been more effective leaders during the pandemic. Let's look at New Zealand. Anyway, our political science research on representation supports this conclusion. Even before the pandemic, experts in the U.S. were examining the influx of women into Congress, where they bring new perspectives to longtime policy debates, and evidence suggests more consensus building to the legislative process. So as we're talking about what you're doing at the Prospect, and I'm reading this article at the Conversation, the critical mass has arrived. You don't need a majority of women. You just need a significant minority of women to begin to bring their voices to the table. And what you have right now, I think, is almost like an Oreo cookie. And what you have is you've got women bringing Biden in because that's who's going to elect him. And then you have women showing up in droves, finally getting elected to Congress and providing the critical mass at a time where we're looking at a pandemic and climate change and economic inequality. If you don't do it now, Harold, when do you do it?
Right. And the first woman vice president as well. I think we're definitely seeing the long term result of, you know, the feminist movement, which has ebbed and flowed. But right now it's flowing, and it's flowing in the channels, electoral channels, political channels, social policy channels, where it has long needed to flow. It is flowing now.
So to pay for these things, what we hear from Joe Biden is, you know, anyone making under $450,000 will not see a tax increase. Anyone over $450,000 will see a tax increase. I think it's really important for people to understand how successful billionaires have been as a result of the pandemic. Oh, you know, sure. We're all thinking that this hurt everyone, that everyone is hurting economically. And what we know now, I think worldwide, the billionaires in this world now have reached $10 trillion in control of wealth. So in a lot of ways, even if you tax the hell out of billionaires, they're still going to be wicked rich. Oh, and I think we don't tell people that. So we keep thinking that the way we're tightening our belts, where some people are now on food lines, where people are starting to worry about how they're paying their mortgage and their property taxes, those people have done exponentially fabulous during the same point in time. So there's money on the table. What we have to do is figure out how to tap it.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the effects of the pandemic and the way the Federal Reserve has dealt with it has been to put a safety net under major corporations, which is to say, essentially, a safety net under stock prices. So stock prices, as everyone who reads any business news knows, have continued to go up while unemployment has soared, while average wage levels have declined because people are working fewer hours if they're working at all. So it simply exacerbated the level of inequality. But you're also right that most people don't really understand how completely unequal we are. And when you tell them that the data show that the average CEO makes 320 times what his, they're almost all male, what his median paid worker makes, they're astonished. When people have put economic distribution data before the public and ask them, how unequal do you think the United States is? They hugely underestimate how unequal it is. And then when asked them, what would you like to see? And they give them various charts. They usually pick the chart that resembles, say, Sweden or Denmark. No, this is true.
I know.
Metaphorically. So whether they know it or not, Americans would really like a social democratic economy where workers have actual power. And that's something we ain't got, but hopefully it would be something that we can move towards if the Democrats have a really good election.
So as I'm thinking about this, visual things are usually helpful.
Yeah.
I gave a speech once at Phillips Exeter, and I think you probably have seen this before. I put 10 chairs on the stage and I asked for 10 volunteers, and each volunteer at least initially represented 10% of the population. And then what I proceeded to do was show them what the wealth inequality looked like. So the one guy with his shoe took the first four chairs, less with his shoe, not even with his body. Then with the rest of his body, he took the next five chairs. And then I had everybody else kind of climbing on top of each other in the last 1.5 chairs. And I said, this is how we divide wealth in America. And this is at Phillips Exeter. And you hear this gasp. And I said, honey bun, you're the shoes. I just want you to know, you're the shoes. I said, I'm on that other end. I said, do you think this is fair? And they were embarrassed, Harold. They did not know. And in a lot of ways, I almost wish that Joe Biden could do the 10 chairs and show people what it looks like. Because as you and I, people are always receptive to taxing the rich.
Yeah.
What I think is so important during this time, because there's been so much economic despair, is that as you have just gone in a spiral downward, they've gone in a spiral upward.
Sure.
So it's not just taxing rich, it's taxing uber rich. And if they saw that, they would have no sense of guilt. In fact, they'd say, you know what? In order for us to survive, it's about time you sort of, you know, cut the tax check.
Right. Well, you know, your listeners cannot see this since you and I are talking on Zoom, Arnie. Over my shoulder is a page I devised when I was editing the LA Weekly in Los Angeles, when the wage level of workers in Haiti who made Disney t-shirts was one story that week, and how much Michael Eisner had made at Disney over the past year was the other story. And I did an equation of how many Haitian garment workers it would take to equal Michael Eisner's salary. What I did was I think I took 360 ships. And then one ship was that classic diagram of how many slaves were packed onto a slave ship. It was, you know, hundreds of thousands. And that's really the economy that we have today. Now, admittedly, American workers make more than Haitian workers, but I did this in the mid-1990s. I think the disparity has since grown to the point where a lot of that illustration is still true.
Well, you see, but again, that's where I think, as you point out, they don't realize what the CEO is making. They right. don't realize how successful the billionaires are. They don't have that sense. And let's also be honest, people can't even comprehend what is $1 billion.
No.
They don't even, it's just a number. But when they see that number compared to what they're making, they don't understand. They will never, ever even get to $1 million if they were earning a certain amount of money. Right. So I think in a lot of ways, this is like doing math for the American people. And the reason why you need to do the math is that the math will explain to them why these rich people will still be incredibly rich. And what will happen is you'll be able to go to a doctor when you're sick. Your kid will have a daycare that you can afford. I mean, when you look at all the quality of life changes, the rich are okay. And so are you.
Well, you know, I mean, there is certainly an awareness in the land that the fortunes of American workers have in some way that people may not understand, but in some way declined. Yes. They understand it if they worked in the industrial economy and now they're in a rust belt. But they don't understand the larger redistribution of wealth. And they kind of get that, as Elizabeth Warren would always say, that the system is rigged. But they don't quite get, you know, just how rigged it is and how much to the benefit of the rich that rigging is. It's beyond their experience, and so it's beyond comprehension. Well, they know the system's screwed up. But most Americans don't realize just how grotesquely the system.
But let me tell you why they don't know. Because the Republicans have been very effective at explaining to them, blame the immigrant
right.
for what's happened with your job. Blame the, you know, blame the African-American who would be an affirmative action for what happened. So what has happened is there's been an explanation for what has happened to their lives economically, but the explanation has been a lie. And unfortunately, my side of the political aisle hasn't been able to sort of challenge that mythology. And so as the Republicans have sort of defined the problem, it is sort of given cover to corporate America. It's given cover to monopolies, given cover to billionaires. And we need to be more full-throated about what really is the problem and say, and if you want to solve it, you can't solve it by putting a wall up on the, you know, on the border between Texas and Mexico. It solves nothing.
And the other aspect of the Republican propaganda is basically saying, all right, you know, the economy is what it is, period. But this is also a challenge to your identity and to the country's identity.
Right.
But the economy isn't, you know, it isn't preordained to be this way. And your life isn't necessarily condemned to one of declining economic realities. And you're right. I mean, the Democrats generally have failed to make these arguments. I mean, you know, back in the day when Lyndon Johnson was running against Barry Goldwater and Barry Goldwater wanted to end Social Security, okay. You could make that argument. People got it. They didn't want to end Social Security. Johnson won in a landslide. But as the economy has grown more imbalanced, you know, one of the things that happened was that lots of Democrats got most of their campaign contributions from the very rich. I mean, one of the great things, one of the side products of the Bernie Sanders revolution, he showed you could raise a lot of money in small donations when real people, you know, we're concerned. And God knows Joe Biden has done that. I mean, I don't know that he would have done that if he weren't running against Donald Trump. But it really does change to a certain degree the financial base of the Democratic Party. And so that's definitely grounds for hope.
Because also I would suggest that the media have been singularly ineffective also, just like the Democratic Party has been ineffective at countering that narrative, the Republican narrative, and it's all about the money.
Well, but the other thing that's really interesting about what Biden was able to collect because it was Donald Trump, but what you saw with Bernie is that we're ready for public financing.
Yep.
That's exactly what this is. Think about this. All these thousands and millions of these little tiny checks. That's what public financing is. It's all these millions of tiny checks. And guess what? It wasn't such a heavy lift for you to write $5. It wasn't such a heavy lift for you to write $10. And you were willing to do it because you were supporting a candidate that you believe in. I know I have only a minute left, but I have to ask you, ranked choice voting is on the ballot in Massachusetts. We know that Maine has passed that. We now are looking at Massachusetts. Is this an answer to anything, or is it really only an answer in primaries?
I think it could be it could be an answer. I mean, if you certainly, you know, had aggregated Ralph Nader's vote and second choice vote for Al Gore in Florida in 2000, there are lots of villages in Iraq that might still be standing. So, yeah, I mean, it's not a panacea, and campaign finance reform and public financing would be more of a panacea, but I'm generally for it.
Well, but you see, the reason why I like ranked choice voting is you mentioned, you know, public financing. You might get public financing if you had ranked choice voting, because instead of getting, you know, you get people who might be more receptive to that idea because they come from a different place, you know, and they're not going to be those that may come in with the big check may not be the second choice. But guess what? The second choice might win despite the fact that big money went one way. And then they're going to want to make sure that the money is sort of spread around. Does that make sense?
A goodness breeds goodness sometimes. And yes, I think that would be one effect.
All right. I know I have to let you go early. So Harold Meyerson, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. And do those 10 chairs. It works incredibly well.
Okay, very good.
All right, ciao.
You, Annie.
All right, bye-bye. Bye-bye. Harold Meyerson is the editor-at-large of the American Prospect, and he joined us today because he has to go and give another speech, but that's okay. We'll schmooze with Ken for the last 3 minutes. So Ken, I think these visual things are so important, and I would actually love to see someone do an ad with the 10 chairs. If you showed people visually, it's kind of like what I told you that John Nichols did about exercising the franchise and how it's expanded and expanded. It was originally only white Protestant men who owned property. Those are the only people that could participate in the vote. And now let's extend it to what's happening in 2020 with people lining up, you know, waiting 10 hours, you know, 3 weeks before the election, just because they want to be able to exercise the franchise and they understand what voter suppression is because their votes are being targeted, but they still have the power of the vote. They have the vote. That's what's so important.
You're right. The visuals can be very effective because you really can get a sense of, you can really wrap your mind around the visual in a way that you can't with just words. Like when Harold said before, that, you know, the CEO salaries are 320 times more than ours. Well, that sounds like a lot, but what does it really mean? I mean, if you showed a pile of money and the pile of money was eensy-meensy for me and you and most of America, and then you show a pile of money for the CEO of American Express and it's 320 times bigger, it looks like a real mitful. And then you show our whole annual salary probably pales in comparison with a week or a month of rich people's salaries, and can see it. You can really get a sense for why we're struggling to pay our mortgage and our rent and food bills, and the rich people are worrying, you know, well, should I get a yacht with chrome trim or with gold trim?
Well, but you know, the other problem I have is that we're not allowed to teach this in civics, that we don't really have civics education. Civics education should be about, let's take a snapshot of the economy. What does it really look like? Okay. What is tax policy? What does it tax? Whose wealth does it tax? Those are things that are important because you're supposed to go into a voting booth and, you know, select the politician who's going to decide exactly what your future is like. But if you are not informed, if you can't make an informed decision because no one's ever taught you, then guess what? Rush Limbaugh dictates the factoid of the day. Fox News gets to tell you the lie du jour. The Republicans who know how to market so well and repeat the marketing lie so often, they're successful. And if you had a real conversation in high school and junior high, and you actually learned about these different things, no one's saying sway someone, just teach them what the different policies are that currently exist. They can make up their own mind, But the problem is no one's ever told them. So they're the most ignorant about the very policies they think they hate. That makes sense?
Right. I'm thinking out loud here, but I almost wonder if walking high school students through one particular bill, one particular piece of legislation that matters to them, and sort of follow it from when the politicians are talking in grandiose terms about making it sound like wonderful stuff, and then seeing how they chop it away and compromise it and have loopholes and exceptions and everything so that the rich people don't have to do it. And,
you
don't really get these benefits unless you're a member of the elite class and whatever.
Well, we need to Anyway, this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We have to say goodbye early to Harold Byerson's, but someday ask me about the civics class I taught to fourth graders. Of my civics class, a little boy at the back of the room went, they lied. And I went, oh, maybe. And on that note, we'll schmooze tomorrow. This is Arnie. Ciao.
This is our life, and these are the times. We are the people, and the dream is alive. Give us the strength to be humble and kind, and respect one another, leaving no one behind. From the mountains and valleys that stretch to the sea, a brand new America is calling to me. I am filled with emotion as the flag is unfurled. A brand new America and a brand new world. We all have a story, and we all have a prayer. We all are equal, and God is fair. So lift up your voice and let freedom ring. Be eternally grateful for everything. From the mountains and valleys that stretch to the sea, a brand new America is calling to me. I am filled with emotion when the flag is unfurled. A brand new America and a brand new world.